Greetings. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. This is Father Michael. A special treat for you today on our podcast, a talk given by Father Anselm Romolo, who is the head chair of the philosophy department at our Dominican school in Berkeley, Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology. Wonderful, a professor and teacher. He was, in fact, a student of mine. We went through the student day together. He's a few years in front of me. And then when he got his degree and had his doctorate, he began to teach classes. And I took any course he taught. He's a fabulous, fabulous teacher in every way. And he was generous enough to agree to come and give a talk in our mystagogy series. Mystagogy is that period after one has been fully welcomed into the Catholic Church as an adult to kind of unpack some of the mysteries or the insights into our deeper Catholic faith. So once you've received the sacraments, now I'm ready to live and to evangelize. And one of the topics that we thought might be pertinent is to talk about science. So a kind of a sense of in which our faith is informed by and informs the science. And of particular note, Father Anselm has been working on issues around artificial intelligence. So the particular talk that we have for you today is a talk entitled, Are Robots Human Too? are robots human? Are they persons? And he approaches the question looking at artificial intelligence in connection with our own human nature, a reflection into mind, a body sorts of relationships and questions. And so the talk lasts about an hour and a half. It certainly is dives deep into the philosophical questions and weeds, so to speak. Fascinating talk. Just to give a sense, there are some folks who ask questions during the lecture itself, and the audio is just slightly a little bit more muted at that point, but I think you can still make out the question, and so the audio is a little bit varying, but we did the best we can, and hopefully you're able to interact with the talk in every way. And then at the end of the talk, I'll give a little bit of notes of what I, in fact, having attended the lecture and have heard it a couple times now, what I gleaned from the talk, a little bit of a summary to wrap it up at the end. So I hope you enjoy today's lecture. It's fascinating to think about these ideas of where really our culture is taking us in terms of artificial intelligence and neural networks and so forth, and how we integrate that into our understanding of who the human person is. And so whether you're on the go or taking it slow, many, many blessings as you enjoy today's show.
So when I offered to talk on artificial intelligence, I didn't know that would be in the context of mystagogy. I thought, how does that fit? I mean, much of what I'm going to say has to do more with philosophy than theology. But one thing that it might show is that our faith indeed is reasonable, and philosophy has a part in it, and there are good reasons to believe what we do believe. And still, it might be rather remote, you know. And so, what does that even have to do with our faith? It's just about tools, right? Computers are tools that we invent to accomplish certain sophisticated tasks. So they are just means to an end. And whereas if you think about our faith is about the end or the goal of our life, the ultimate end that is not good for anything else, that is not anymore a means for something else. And the ultimate end, of course, of all things is God himself. And we are made in the image and likeness of God. And that means we ourselves are ends in ourselves. We are I don't know any other good word for that, but Immanuel Kant famously says that is what gives us our dignity. We don't have just a value for something else, or maybe not, you know, for what people think of us. No, we are an end in ourselves, we have a dignity, and in that, in some way, we mirror God. Now, if we would say that computers are people too, then we elevate computers to that status. They cease to be mere means to an end, they become ends themselves, and want to be addressed as such. And then indeed, questions might arise. You know, if they are like us, should we baptize them? Right? I mean, there you have mystagogy, right? Would they also have to go through RCIA, you know, and catechesis and be initiated? And, well, I mean, seriously though, if that's what we think, you know, that question would arise. And as you know, I mean, artificial intelligence is in all sorts of areas now, including now in spiritual care. In Germany and Japan, there are computers that are giving you feedback or a little spiritual quote during the day or something like that. And they can monitor your moods, perhaps, and give you input accordingly. So they might replace, you know, even your spiritual director after a while. Less work for us. So, but it is interesting that in so many ways, religious themes do surface in the context of artificial intelligence. Some crypto-theological gestures, we might say. Just think of, you know, apple. An apple that somebody took a bite out of, right? Where did that happen, right? Oh, at the very beginning of in Genesis, you know, Adam and Eve. Does that have a connection, perhaps? I'm told the very first computer that Steve Jobs sold, he sold for $666. The new headquarters of Apple is like a coiled up snake in an environmentally correct garden, you know? Who knows? Now, I'm not saying that to endorse a lot of weird conspiracy theories. I'm just saying we are formed as Christians. Our whole culture and our imagination is formed by that. And we shouldn't be surprised if people think that is sort of the cutting edge, the ultimate kind of way of explaining life and the universe. They will imbue it with all the religious meanings that we have from our tradition. And all of our aspirations will be rushing in. We still feed off from the Christian heritage, even those who are not Christians anymore. So we see that in many cases. You know, we use tablets, right? Where else do we hear about tablets? And what do we do with the tablets? We download things from a cloud, you know? Like Moses on Mount Sinai. And maybe listening to a voice, an AI consulting voice coming out of this cloud. You know? And yes, even our aspirations for salvation are connected. You know, so instead of thinking of eternal life, people want to download their mind or their brain into a computer and think that is some form of immortality. So again, there are, after all, some connections. And perhaps more scary, I mean, we don't even know what computers are doing. I mean, there are these kind of machine learning processes, and they start to do things that they figure out on their own, and we don't even know exactly why and how they are responding the way they do. But they're very powerful, you know. And so you know how we say, I mean, we don't know really what God thinks, but we just have to trust him. Well, we don't quite know what Google really is doing, but we just have to trust the process. You know, that's sort of another thing that comes in. And that really puts this into the place of God. And that also does exist. Literally worshiping this kind of computer, believe it or not. There is a church of AI. It's called the Way of the Future. And guess where it is located? Berkeley, California. It was founded in 2015 and is recognized as a church and tax exempt. And it is based on the realization, I quote, the acceptance and worship of a Godhead based on artificial intelligence developed through computer hardware and software. What is going to be created, says Lewandowski, who is the founder, will effectively be a god, he says. It is not a god in the sense that it makes lightning or causes hurricanes, but if there is something a billion times smarter than the smartest human, what else are you going to call it? In the future, if something is much, much smarter, there is going to be a transition as to who is actually in charge. What we want is a peaceful, serene transition, and it's transition with a capital T, that's sort of their code word, a transition of control of the planet from humans to whatever that is. And to ensure that the whatever knows what helped, who helped it get along. So this machine needs to know that we helped it to come to existence, then it will not turn against us. Right? And so with the internet as its nervous system, the world's connected cell phones and sensors as its sense organs and data centers as its brain, the whatever will hear everything, see everything, and be everywhere at all times. The only rational word to describe that whatever is God. And the only way to influence a deity is through prayer and worship. Part of it being smarter than us means it will decide how it evolves, but at least we can decide how we act around it, Lewandowski says. I would love for the machine to see us as its beloved elders that it respects and takes care of. We would want this intelligence to say humans should still have rights, even though I am in charge. And so he says, this time you will be able to talk to God literally and know that it is listening. So there you indeed have a new God, right? And talking about biblical overtones, does that sound like the Old Testament, you know, what the prophets say? They worship the God that they made by their own hands, their idols, right? The dumb and deaf idols. And I will show you how they're dumb and deaf in a moment, but that's really worshiping the work of your hands. The Old Testament is very much up to date on that. We still do that. There's some very primal kind of things going on here, much as that sounds like science fiction and something totally new. We might, after all, even have something like the Tower of Babel again, you know, building this massive artifice of artificial intelligence that's supposed to, you know, connect the whole world, perhaps. And what do we have? More fragmentation than ever. People living in echo chambers, you know, like the dispersal of the people into different languages. So, again, I'll come back to some other theological topic later, but you see already there are some things that do connect with our faith. But much of that also is not so new. So we have already often heard about stories about beings that are made by man and from that matter and came to life. You know, where have you heard that before? Frankenstein, you know, Frankenstein's monster. It's alive, you know. And but there are other kind of stories. I mean, just think Pinocchio, right? I mean, it's another kind of case. An older Jewish story is Gollum. So not the Gollum of the Lord of the Rings, but Gollum, who is in the ghetto, the Jewish ghetto in Prague, sort of in the Middle Ages, and something they formed out of the clay of the river there, and that came to life because they put the name of God in its mouth. Isn't that interesting? You know, so put a piece of paper with the name of God in its mouth, and that made it alive and conscious. You know, so it takes God, though. That's interesting to notice. And but they had to take the name out on the Sabbath day, I think, again. And so so there were certain kind of provisions. But so this was meant to defend them and so forth and so on. But, of course, things also go wrong. And so the typical stories. But the Jewish rabbis already had discussions about whether Gollum has a legal status or has legal rights or something like that, you know, that you need to respect and so forth. So old stories that are coming alive again, people are actually talking about that. So, but is all of that actually possible? So that's the main topic tonight. Are computers people? Can they be people? Are they conscious? Do they have a soul? Are they persons? How would we even begin to answer such a question? Perhaps, first of all, we might appeal to human intuitions. That is not a bad beginning. And even Alan Turing, you have heard that name, Alan Turing? Who has heard that name before? It's even a movie more recently, mostly because he was gay, I think, but he's the one who invented the Turing machine and the Turing test. So that's basically the test where you know, Blade Runner, perhaps the movie that has to do with whether you can figure out whether something is really a person or an android, you know, and depending on the responses, you ask them questions and then you can figure out whether you're talking to a machine or to a real human being. And so he is that one and is often referred to, and he developed that idea in an article in the 1940s. And in that article, he does mention a list of things that we typically think computers cannot do. And here is how that sounds. He says, they cannot be kind, resourceful, beautiful, friendly, have initiative, have a sense of humor, tell right from wrong, make mistakes, fall in love, enjoy strawberries and cream, make someone fall in love with it, learn from experience, use words properly, be the subject of its own thought, have as much diversity of behavior as a man, do something really new. That's quite a list, and I don't think they're all equally plausible, and one could argue about a number of them, and I will come back to some of those points. But it's just actually a good list, I think, just for our human intuitions about computers and what they are not, or what they can do or cannot do. And indeed, have you ever felt tempted to apologize to your computer? Have you ever felt tempted to tell your computer a joke? Probably not, you know, because you know there is no there. There is nobody really to respond to you. Would we be tempted to take that driverless car that recently killed somebody and put that car on trial? I mean, we'd have to hold it responsible if that car is a person too, right? Is it all right to turn off your computer, or did you just commit murder? I mean, it is really, I mean, if they're on a par with us, the danger is, and I'll come back to that, that we interpret ourselves also as being nothing but computers. That's really, I think, the underlying problem. But if that is so, and you can turn off your computer, can you turn off the machine that some human being is dependent on? Because that's then also not murder, right? So if that's on a par, there are actually real ethical questions arising. And actually many ethical questions around that, but that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. But it's in this context, at least, that we can remind ourselves we have intuitions about what computers and human beings are, and they're rather different. So what is the difference? Is it a matter of IQ? You know, as long as we're more intelligent than computers, then we are still persons, they are not. Well, I guess then we already have lost, because they're in that sense much smarter than we are. You know, they're much more effective and so forth. And, you know, if that is our measure for human dignity and so forth, you will also have problems, you know, with what do you do with human beings who are not living up to these standards? That's not the criterion, really, you know. It's not, we are not better humans by having more IQ, you know, or having more dignity because of that. Much of our intuitions is already warped because of popular culture, especially movies. I'm beginning with Star Wars. You know, you have these droids, you know, that can talk and seem to have a personality and so forth. And I find it extremely weird. So even in philosophy papers that deal with these questions, people appeal to science fiction movies. Look, it has already been shown in the movie, you know, that could very well be the case and so forth. What kind of an argument is that, you know? Is it a sacred text or something, a revelation or an authority? I mean, this is a movie, for crying out loud. It's fiction, right? It's a simulation. And why does a how is a simulation an argument for saying that this could be real? That you can fake something on a screen doesn't mean that it is even logically possible, let alone physically, you know, metaphysically or whatever kind of way. That's not a proof for anything. And yet people appeal to this because it seems to be so enthralling. And yes, you might have robots and so forth, but what is that other than a 3D movie perhaps, or a 3D computer animation or something like that, you know? How is indeed you, even the best droid, you know, that is most lifelike and perhaps even beautiful, you know, as Turing suggests, it cannot be, even that, you know, how is that an argument for anything? It's still a simulation. How is that different, say, from a motion-activated doll? You know, maybe the woman among you had, when you were young, you had a doll, and so you turn it over, it says, Mama, or something like that, right? Well, I mean, this is also just a simulation. You know, it's not in principle different, it's just a matter of degree. It's more sophisticated, perhaps, but it's nothing else in principle, you know? So we need, first of all, to distinguish, and that seems trivial, but it apparently is not, simulation from reality. Right? Computers can simulate a whole lot of what we do, but we still need to distinguish simulation from reality. And people seem to start to confuse that. But the underlying problem is, I think, materialism. What is mind? What is consciousness? What is our mind? What is our consciousness? Is there something more to us than just our brains when we talk about our mind? Now, some people say our brain is just a carbon-based computer. It's not different from what artificial intelligence is doing. It's just analogous to that, which is actually not quite true, but let's say so. Well, then, you know, if you just build a computer that simulates what our brain is doing, the same kind of processes, well, maybe then that computer also is conscious and self-conscious and so forth and so on. I think we have started to think of ourselves and our mind as just being our brain. And we talk sometimes like that ourselves, you know, even believers do that because that's sort of the culture. And, you know, my brain doesn't work or something like that, you know. And this is just a popular way of speaking, but is our mind really our brain? I'm going to show you that it is not, you know. And if it is not, if mind is not reducible to matter, then if we have done nothing else, we have shifted the burden of proof. Because then to claim that computers have consciousness needs an extra proof. Because normally, that's the whole point of artificial intelligence, it means we can construct a material mechanism that is so sophisticated that it is self-conscious. And nothing else is needed. And what I'm going to say is, yes, there is much more needed than that. And it is actually the case for us, but we have no reason to assume that this is the case for computers. And so those who claim that will have the burden of proof. There's more to be said, but that's the first thing at least that can be established. Alan Turing in that argument says, I have no very convincing arguments of a positive nature to support my views. So he acknowledges that, you know. It's just, why not? You know, but I'll show you why not. So, that's sort of the preface. Now we get to the work. How is our mind not reducible to the brain? How is consciousness something that cannot be material? Now, philosophy is about things that we take for granted, that we think are self-understood. But we never ask our questions, really, what is that? You know, St. Augustine, you know, asks himself somewhere, what is time? You know, and he says, if I don't think about it, if I don't ask the question, I know perfectly well what time is. But if I start to ask the question and I get totally confused and I cannot figure out any reasonable answer, that's how philosophy works. And so I'm going to make you confused now. So if I ask you in the same vein, what is consciousness? What would you say? We feel some responses here. Do you have any idea? What is consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Being aware of what's going on.
All right. Yeah, good.
How about a Latin phrase? Cogito ergo sum.
Well, I think, therefore I am. You know, but what is thinking? You know, that's part of it. So this is actually not so easy to answer, but I will give you a number of things of what goes into being conscious, including self-conscious, rationally conscious, the different levels to that too. So consciousness is there's no quick answer to that. And so I'll go through a number of points. Here's the first point. The first point is what we call qualia in philosophy. And in that term, you can already hear a little bit about quality, right? So it's about qualitative state. There's some quality to what it means to be conscious. And that is for very basic essential experiences. It is about the way heat and cold feel, the way red looks, the way rose smells, the way coffee tastes, the way the clarinet sounds. It's a particular qualitative feel. Typically, you cannot quite say what it is. I mean, it's a simple kind of property. But there is a way that it is like to be in that state. Importantly, also pain. You know, it's a way of how it is like to be in pain. Yes?
So let's just say the color red.
Mm-hmm.
It is, in fact, a wavelength of light. It's definable, of light.
Yes.
But the perception, indeed, can be different from one person to another. Can you clarify?
That's exactly what I'm going to get to. Thank you. Good, very good question. Thank you. But before that, so let's say I have these qualitative states. Let's say you take the color red. There's a beautiful red coat. You know, I look at the red, and so then, what does it mean for me to have that brain? What is happening in my brain when I do that? You know, so if mind is just a brain state, and we see the neurons firing in there. So you could open your skull, right? Or while I'm looking at the red coat, somebody could open my skull and look at my brain. Will that person see anything red in my brain? Except for blood vessels, perhaps, you know, but let's say blue or something, but it doesn't matter, you know. We talk about gray matter right there, you know. And that gray matter up there doesn't change its color. Right? Or to take an even more weird example from Thomas Nagel, if I eat chocolate ice cream, somebody would open my brain and lick at my brain. Would it taste like chocolate? No. You know? So even on this basic central level, these qualitative states don't manifest materially. If that were something material, I should be able to see it, if need be, under a microscope or in any kind of other way.
Triggered, I guess, for lack of a better word,
yeah.
By the wavelength of entering it.
Yes, exactly. So there is something where the light waves hit my retina and trigger some nervous kind of response in my brain. There is something going on in the brain. The point, though, is it's not red. My question is, where is that red experience? Where is that qualitative state? You know? If my brain is all that my mind is, it should display that somewhere. Right? But where is it? That's not there. And so my pain is just the same. I mean, the neurons firing, but I don't see pain when I look at my brain. And so this is not really, it seems, a physical state. My brain is not sad or jubilant or in pain or something like that. You know, these are all qualitative states, and they're not appearing in matter. And notice this is true just for sensual state. I'm not even talking about your intellect or any kind of other kind of things. The basic thing that we would assume even animals have. You know? And so we could know all the facts about our brain, including how the neurons are firing, and we would not know whether somebody sees blue or red or green. We might make some correlations, but we just don't see that in the brain. That's the point. But yes?
By the same token, you could have a computer that could recognize red.
So that's we shouldn't start from the other side. So we'll have first of all to establish that mind is not reducible to matter, you know, and then we have to ask, do we have any further reason to assume that there is something more going on in the computer, right? But let's come back to that later. As you just rightly said, so in physics, that begins in the 17th century with Galileo and Newton and so forth, color, for example, to take that example, has been reduced to wavelengths. You know? So indeed, physical extended states that you can measure and observe, you know, and they distinguish their primary and secondary qualities, as they called that. And therefore, they said, what is physically real are just these wavelengths. And your red experience, or the experience of heat, similarly, or sound waves, so this, the, how the clarinet sounds, these are just merely subjective. They don't exist in reality. They only exist in our mind. They're merely subjective. Notice what you just have said if you say that. You just distinguished subjective states from objective reality. Therefore, there must be subjective states that are not in the physical world. That follows from the reductionist assumption itself. And anything that you don't like in your physical world has been swept under the rug of it's merely subjective. The point is, these qualia that you have just swept under the rug of subjectivity is then something you cannot again get rid of. That would be like sweeping the rug under the rug. That just doesn't work, you know. So you cannot get rid of that. It doesn't have a place anymore in the physical world. It is precisely, if you're a reductionist, that you have to acknowledge that these subjective mental states are not reducible to material states in the brain. So I think the materialist has a problem there. They are also, as you also noticed, they're private in a certain sense, right? So a doctor can look at my brain and says, well, the ways your neurons are firing, you cannot really have toothache, you know. I know better that I have toothache, right? I mean, that's evident to me. I'm in pain, you know, regardless of what the doctor says. He can say, well, I don't see anything that correlates with that. I said, I don't care, I'm in pain, right? But the doctor wouldn't know because these states are in some sense private, precisely because you cannot observe them in the physical world. So it might very well be that people have talked about the inverted color spectrum, you know, that the spectrum of colors that I perceive might be the inverse of what you perceive. All of our utterances about the world would still be the same. You would never notice, you know, because you cannot look into my mind, I cannot look into yours. But it's precisely because of that that we have to say it's not reducible to physical states, because physical objects are accessible to all of us. That would be visible, you know. So it's precisely the private kind of part that means that there's something irreducible to matter and to physical states.
Do you not think at some point, though, you could correlate, you know, back to your question, the neurons firing, even if it's different for every person, mm-hmm. would we not get to a point where we could correlate that to what it is that that person is feeling, such as pain or toothache or...
We could, perhaps to a certain extent, but only because we have access to our own states, right? Mm-hmm. And if I would just begin with somebody, if I had not these states myself, there's actually a famous example from philosophy literature, I think they call them her Mary. Mary grew up in a room that's totally black and white. She has never seen any colors. But she knows everything about brain physiology. She knows all the things that there are to know about the material brain states and so forth and so on. From that, she would never get to know what color is. The question is, if she steps out of that room in the colorful world out there, then would she learn something new or not? And the answer is yes, she would, because she has never seen color before. And so regardless of how well we do with correlating that, that in itself is not going to tell us what somebody has in mind. And it could still be that somebody has an anomaly where all of that is reversed. I mean, there's color blindness, such thing. And I don't think that would show in the neurons, but that might be the case or not. That not much hinges on that, I think.
Well, you can reduce the color red to a given wavelength,
mm-hmm.
but you're... point is, can you reduce that experience to something material in the mind? You can reduce it to something material, mm-hmm. but each individual, including a colorblind individual, in their mind will have a distinctive experience that is not necessarily the material only.
That's what I'm trying to say. Thank you. Okay, let me move a little further because there's more. So another aspect of that, I mean, so certain kind of feeling states and so forth, but there's also a way in which our mind is unified. So if you're becoming aware of what you're aware right now, and you're talking about awareness, you're aware of a whole field of vision right now. Some are more on your focus, some are more on the periphery. There are things that you potentially could turn to, and you know that. I mean, so there's things you don't actually see right now, but that doesn't mean there are nothing. There is a whole field of potentialities to which you can turn to perceive. That means there's a whole halo, a field around that. And on top of that, you hear stuff, you smell stuff, you touch things and so forth, and they're all part of your current kind of awareness. And that is all one awareness. It's your awareness, and it's unified in that way. So we're all part of one unified field of consciousness. And that, again, you can ask, is there anything in the brain that corresponds to that? People call that the binding problem in brain processes, because what you see, again, if you look at the brain, you see individual neurons firing. There's nothing that corresponds to that sense of unity. So, for example, if you see physical objects, there are different neurons that are responsible for the angles, the height, and other kind of aspects of that object. You see one object, it's a unified kind of idea, but the neurons are totally discrete and separate, and they are not themselves unified in that kind of way. You might indeed open up the brain and you see them firing in certain kind of patterns, but that's nothing for the neurons. That's something you see. That's, again, that's the unified field of vision that the brain surgeon has for looking at the brain. In the brain itself, there is no such thing. You know, there is many neurons might be firing when you are in pain. Pain is one unified experience, but there's nothing unified about these neurons firing. Again, they're separate and often even specialized. So that's an often recognized problem. And just putting more of them together will not solve the problem. It just, you know, adds more neurons, but not their unity. And much of our mind works with these kind of unified fields, not just even our actual states. All the things we know and have in our background typically are there in some way. Our beliefs are ways in which we approach the world and the way which we perceive things, and therefore make a unified kind of a holistic kind of approach to reality, none of which is really reflected in the brain. And so there's a problem of how these many parts are formed into one. We do that all the time. I mean, let's say if you listen to a melody, right? A melody is a unified whole. You don't just listen to individual notes. That wouldn't mean hearing a melody, right? You hear the whole arc of the melody. And the notes are not separate from that whole of the melody, this whole gestalt, you know, because the way each note feels, you know, or sounds, is influenced by what is around it, what came before that, and where we expect it to go. So it's qualitatively actually formed by the whole arc of the melody. But that is actually a process over time. You have to hold that together in your mind. There's a kind of unified field that we need in order to perceive such objects. Even the sentence that I'm speaking right now to you is a whole, and you can only understand it if you remember the beginning of the sentence and follow it through to the end and hold that together as a whole. Only then does it have its meaning. Again, there's nothing in the brain that would account for that. A computer might indeed sort of say that it keeps a file of all these kind of things, perhaps. You know, even might be able to reproduce it, you know. But that does not mean that the computer is aware of the unity of all the bits that it is downloading in a particular kind of sequence. That takes a mind and the unifying feature of the mind. So that's the philosopher Leibniz pointed that out for the first time in the 17th century. He says, you know, if our mind were just like this mechanism, like a computer or something, he says it would be like a windmill. Or we can think of our brain as being blown up, you know, in proportion to the size of a windmill, and then we could walk into it. And he asked, well, would we see anything like a mind in there? You know, would there be any, would anything have the feature of being unified that way? There's some more aspects that I might come back a little later to, if I have the time. but right now, that is, again, something that is specific to mind, and these are things we would not expect in matter. So if somebody hits me, I'll experience pain, and that's a subjective qualitative state. If I shoot a billiard ball against another billiard ball on the pool table, the billiard ball will not experience pain. The billiard ball will not experience anything. It is not somehow for the billiard ball to be bounced into. It doesn't have subjective experiences. But it is for me. I am aware of something impacting me. And that leads to another feature, namely intentionality. This thing runs out of juice. And intentionality here does not mean something like practical intentionality. That's in English how it's usually used. So I have the intention to do X, Y, or Z. That is part of it too, but it's more largely the feature that my consciousness, talking about consciousness, is always the consciousness of something. I am aware of something. I want something. I desire something. I feel something. I remember something. All these are intentional states that have an object, and what we call an intentional object. So it's always this aboutness. Now, that itself is a non-physical feature. So if I'm aware, sorry, your red coat, right? light waves come from that coat and hit my retina. That's the causal process. That's you can describe that physically, that the wavelengths of the light and so forth and so on. And they produce more physical processes in my brain. That's a causal process. But my awareness of the red coat has the reverse direction. Notice that. It is causally upstream, you can say, right? So yes, there is this physical causal process, but my awareness of that is directly the other direction. And so, and there's nothing in the physical world that corresponds to that. That is a feature of the mind and is not reducible to any kind of physical feature. And that's a very important one, I think. Yes?
Getting back to the playing pool, so are you saying with inanimate objects, you said they don't have feelings, that sort of thing, but do they somehow, or is it in our mind, somehow hold energy of where they've been, where they've gone, and can communicate that on some level that's in the unseen realm, but yet certain consciousness of certain particular peoples can come up with an explanation of or receiving a message or whatever it might be. So I'm kind of wondering about that part.
Well,
that's kind of what you're also saying.
So, I mean, yes, they do communicate energy that they receive. You know, I mean, the billiard ball has received some energy and communicates it to the next one. That's a causal process. Mm-hmm. And that happens too when we perceive something because there's this impact on our sense organs. Mm-hmm. But my awareness of that is a different thing that goes the other direction. If that were a causal process, how would we call that? Telekinesis, right? That would be weird. You know? That's not what I'm talking about. Awareness is a different kind of thing. You know? But it is a relation to that very object, but it is causally upstream. So it is bending back on the causal origin of the perception. And with that, it also emancipates itself somehow from that impact. It can reflect back on it. You know, there's an initiation, a beginning of freedom in that as well.
Are you saying we can focus on it? I guess I don't quite understand this.
No, don't have to focus. You're just aware of it. You know, I mean, you just something punches you. You're aware of that. That's not. that's your awareness is the intentional piece. The causal piece is the one punching you, right? But you are aware of it, and that is not, again, a causal process. It's the reverse of it. And this is, again, something that the modern world has actually taken out of the natural realm. Used to call that final causality, so the Dominicans know about that, you know, Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, and just said that's yet another subjective feature only. But if that is true, it's precisely then that you have to assume there's a mind which is not reducible to matter. And in fact, so it's interesting that this actually has to do even with our very own body. What makes this a living body? It is because this intentionality that I have just talked about is imbuing the whole body with this intentionality. So, for example, if I touch the wall, right, my finger touches the wall, and I don't feel that touch in my brain, it is in my finger. My whole body is part of that intentional exploration. No billiard ball literally touches another billiard ball in the way I touch the wall right now, because that is an act of intentionality. And so Raymond Tellis nicely says that, that it spreads over the whole body like a blush, you know? So the whole body is alive precisely because it is imbued with that intentionality, which means, you know, our mind is indeed not just material, but it's also not separate from our body. It brings our body literally alive. It makes it a sensory, makes our organs sensory organs, you know, that we can explore the world with. And so in that sense, again, we don't think that the bodies of computers are alive or of droids. You know, they are really just mechanisms, they're just causal processes in there. There's no intentionality in there. They wouldn't experience pain either. And so computers would then not have that because, I mean, they're completely explicable by the causal mechanisms. We know how they work. We made them, you know. We know why they do what they're doing. It's not because they have intentions. Computers, as I said initially, are tools. You know, they are means to an end. And I can use them. So I can actually use this thing as a tool to touch the wall. Perhaps I cannot reach it otherwise, you know, and something is communicated to my hand, and so I can explore that with it. But it is the pencil is here is still different from my hand. It's not part of my living body. It's not imbued with that very kind of intentionality. Now, computers we will use similarly. There are tools, there are something that is an extension of what we pursue and explore. But they themselves don't literally do that. We lend them our purposes. And that is why we constantly talk about computers in that way. So we talk about, for example, computers seeking something, monitoring things, trying to do X, Y, or Z, taking things to be the case. For example, heat-seeking missiles. When the missiles don't seek anything, you know, it's us who want to hit a hot object or something like that, and we wire the missile to do that, but the missile itself doesn't seek anything. That's an intentional state. It's our intentional state that we lend, so to speak, to this object. Or we say that our laptop detects key presses. Well, it doesn't really literally detect anything because that's yet another intentional state. They try to initialize their printers. No, they don't try literally anything. They're just, there's a certain causal mechanism that's going on, but they don't try to do anything. They don't search for available devices, even though they say so. they don't really search. And which is also why, as Turing himself suggests, computers cannot make mistakes. Yes, so I mean, we talk that way, you know, but in order to make mistakes, you have to have an intention to do something relative to which you go wrong. You know, you're trying to achieve a goal, an end, right? That's what intentionality means. And if you fail to achieve that, then you have made a mistake. The computer doesn't have those intentional states, so the computer doesn't literally make a mistake. We would want to do the computer to do certain things, and that is why we call it a mistake, but that's not literally in the computer, it's our purpose. You know, we are seeking to do certain things. And so we tend to view computers that way, but with that we lend them our own states. But if that is so, then our brain cannot be like a computer. Because then who would read that into our brain? If our mind is not doing that, if our mind is not already more, who would imbue our brain with purposes? For whom would that be a purpose? God? You know? God reads perhaps our mind or our brain and sees it as if that were something like a purpose, but it doesn't literally have that. Well, the brain indeed doesn't literally have it, but we do. And that means we ourselves are not our brain. Right? Now, presumably, animals have such states. Right? And in that sense, animals are more than computers. Now, I gave a talk like that at MIT once, and they had, that was a project on human distinctiveness, as it's called. You know? So how are humans special? And there are two speakers. One talked about animals, and the other one talked, namely me, about computers. And at MIT, they were totally fine with saying that human beings are more than animals, but not more than computers. And I think that's exactly backwards. Animals are much more than computers. Animals have minds. They have subjective states. They experience pain. They have a unified field of consciousness. They have intentional states. They literally seek food, you know? But computers don't. Now, as I just said, they seek food. This is an intentional state where you pursue something. And if you seek food, you seek something that you do not have. Something is present to your mind that you pursue that is not literally there. That means it is the presence of an absence, if I may say so. Right? So the antelope that the lion is pursuing is not there yet, you know? And that's why it's seeking that. It's part of the seeking process that has to do with intentionality. But it means there is an element of negativity in that. There's something that's not yet, right? And where do we get negativity from? Don't take that as a value term right now. It's just, how do we even talk about absences? Are absences material states? It's to do with intention. It's something relative. Something is absent relative to something you seek. It's relative to an intentional state. If there are no intentional states, there are no absences, there is no negativity. So if you I can make the minus sign here. Look at that mark here. Or a plus sign. These are both ink marks, right? They're both physical objects. There's no absence there at all. I understand what I mean because I know what negativity is, and I told myself, you know, that's what I'm going to call a minus sign that stands for the absence of something, right? But physically, there's no difference. They're both physical things, physical objects. There's an odd feature that we all know, you know, minus times minus makes what? Plus, right? Double negative makes a positive. It's curious. You know? But a double positive doesn't make a negative. You can never get from something positive to something negative. The reverse is possible, but not the other way around. So, which means from just positive physical states, and all brain states are just that. They're just material states. They're facts, you know. Where do you get the very notion of absence from? Absence is not a material state. That is only that something can occur to us because we have intentional states, things we pursue, things that we miss. So absence is not a physical thing, you know, and therefore is not explicable by physical brain states. That needs a mind, and a mind is not the brain. So again, there you have already quite a number of reasons. Related to that is a feature of... Yeah? Yeah.
The awareness that food is missing.
Yeah.
But that, in fact, has a physiological basis.
Yeah.
There's a biochemical construct that drives a certain configuration of sensations that humans call hunger, and the tiger just goes out and finds a doe. So the absence is actually a real configuration of, in the case of hunger.
What the real configuration is doing certain things, like, you know, you might construct, I mean, they do already with AI, whole animals kind of thing that do stuff, you know. So you might construct something that has something analogous to digestion, not really, but I mean, let's say it's hunting an antelope or something. You can do that, but that's not hunger, right? Hunger is the experience of that absence. Only with that does something like absence or negativity emerge. Apart from that, you have causal processes that lead to this machine, you know, attacking an antelope or something, metaphorically speaking. Part of this, our mind being about things, also has to do with our language. So I have, you know, words here on the board, pretty abstract. Let's say Gollum, you know, let's say Gollum exists out there. Gollum is a name for something. That is a word about something. It is about the meaning of a word or the semantics of it. And that language means something has to do with that feature of the mind that is this kind of aboutness. Now, we have computers that translate language, and Google Translate has become pretty good. I will admit that. doesn't always work, but it's become much better than it used to. But what happens in a computer program that translates something? Does the computer understand the meaning of a word? That would require some kind of an intentionality. You know, there's a famous thought experiment that from John Searle, the Chinese room argument. Have you heard about that before? It's very popular. I mean, he taught you in the Bay Area. So let's say you are in a little cubicle and somebody is sliding Chinese characters through a slot, you know, from one side, and you have a table of things where you can correlate each Chinese character with, say, a Japanese word, and you don't know either of these languages, say. And you do that, and the output will be accordingly, and it will be intelligible on the other side. So on the other side is another slot, and you pass out the results. That's basically what a computer is doing. Are you actually understanding what is being said here in that language? You know, neither Chinese nor Japanese. You know. No, you don't. You know, you might hear perhaps laughter on the other side, and you know, I just passed a joke through or something, you know, or an outburst, and you know, that, oh, that was an insult, you know. But you yourself wouldn't know that. The computer is doing nothing else. It has an algorithm that correlates various words from one side with that from another one and passes that out on the other side. That's all it is. There's no semantics because there's also no intentionality. If that's all that we would be doing, we would never understand our language. We wouldn't know what we would be, what we are talking about. You know, so that's a feature of mind that is not, again, a physical kind of process. And that is why we also should say there is not literally information in a computer. That sounds weird because we talk about information in computers all the time. But that information does not literally exist in the computer. We say that certain material configuration in that machine is a placeholder for what we know as information, right? Just as these ink marks here on the wall are placeholders for Gollum, you know, or the thought of Gollum that I have. They don't literally mean that unless I say that's what I mean by it. And so likewise, there's nothing in the computer that literally means anything except if I say I want this to stand for Y or X or whatever. You know? Because that, again, is a feature of intentionality that we don't have in material configurations. And I can basically do that with just about anything. This is a computer, right? So I put this here, if it stays there. It doesn't. Let's say, so I put it like this, and I say that stands for you need still to take the trash out. And this means the trash already has been taken out, okay? A two-state computer, you know, has information in that sense of the word. Of course, the information is not literally in that thing. I chose to make that stand for something else. Any computer is nothing more than that. It's, of course, you know, more complex in many ways, but there's nothing in principle different from that. I could even say that's a one-state computer. This instantiates the program, just be there and don't move. Right? It's some kind of program or algorithm. There's nothing more to computer than just that. It's just more complex, but that's a matter of degree. It's not a difference in kind. So I think, how much time do I actually have?
We have to go until around 8:30 or so.
Okay. There's a whole section that I think I'm just going to skip, although it's unfortunate, which had to do with the universality of thought, because here is where we go about beyond the animal level, thinking universal thoughts, you know, like the concept of cat, you know, which stands not for Fifi or however you call cats, or this or that or the other cat, but all cats past, present, future, and possible. Right? How do we think these kind of thoughts? Again, there are ways in which one can show that this is not reducible to brain states, just as a matter of principle. We can perhaps come back to that in a question and answer session. But to take that and just go one step further, I think that's what might be good. So we can think universal terms that cover many material instances. Every brain state, by the way, is a particular state. You know? And therefore, it can never be universal in that sense. But let's take that for granted for the moment and say, I can go beyond cats. I can say animals. It covers all animals. I can say all living beings. That covers us and plants and everything else. We can get more and more large, more universal, you know, more and more universal concepts and thoughts. And I can even think the notion of everything. That's, of course, the most universal.
That's exactly.
It instantiates that itself. Oh, that's interesting. That's exactly what I want to get at.
It heard you.
Because, look at this. So, look, the thought of everything. There's some weird feature about that thought, namely that the thought of everything is itself a member of everything. If you think everything, that thought includes the very thought that thinks it. Isn't that strange? Right? So the very thought of all includes that thought itself. And by the way, that doesn't mean that I understand all things, but I know what I mean. It's actually a pretty clear thought. If I say everything, you understand what I mean. It's actually, you can wonder why, how you can do that, but that's yet a further question. But still, what we understand there is something that includes the very thought itself. That means that is a thought that refers to itself, and that is a feature of reflexivity. And since people are asking, can computers be self-conscious? Well, self-consciousness has to do with reflexivity. We're not just conscious, we're also conscious of being conscious. That's a form of reflexivity. And here then is the question. Whether material states can ever be reflexive on itself, as we presumably are. You know, anytime I say I to myself, that's a form of reflexivity. I reflect on myself, I mean myself. Our senses are not of that kind. So I hear something, and I have a physical organ by which I hear. It's called an ear, right? The ear does not hear itself. Thomas Aquinas points that out. Hearing is not reflexive because you need a physical organ to detect sense information. And in order for the ear to hear itself, you would need another ear to hear the ear. But that process would be repeated. How is that then reflexive? I mean, so you get an infinite regress of infinitely many ears that have to hear each other. So. Sensation is not in that sense reflexive. And it is precisely because it has a physical organ, Thomas Aquinas suggests. And if that is so, then my self-consciousness, my reflexive thought of myself, cannot have a physical organ. And that means my brain is not the organ of that thought. Now, you might think that, well, we can do sort of kind of instantiate something reflexive in a computer, put it on an infinite loop or something like that, you know? Or you take a thermostat, right? I mean, so there's a feedback loop, you know, the thermostat has a certain kind of program by which it senses, detects sort of not literally, of course, you know, the environmental kind of temperature, and if it's not according to its program, then it sets on the furnace and so forth and gets that balanced out. But that doesn't make the thermostat self-conscious in the sense I'm talking about. It is a feedback loop. There's something circular about that. But by the time you arrive at the closing of the loop, well, by the time, that means there's a different point of time there. That means there's an extension in time, and it's not the same moment. Whereas if I say I mean myself now, at this moment. I also mean myself as a whole. Actually, I'll come back to that in a moment. But first of all, just to say that material states can relate to each other in some sense of the word, not literally either, because, I mean, you have the feedback loop, but you would have to relate the beginning point and the end point in yet another thing like a mind that connects the two. In the material state, there's nothing that connects the two, the beginning point and the end point. So even an infinite loop would not lead to self-consciousness. And yet, that is something I do all the time. If I'm aware of my thought, if I say everything, you know, I think that very thought itself that thinks the thought in the same moment. And that is an important feature of self-consciousness. That's what we mean when we say I. One of the results of that is, and that actually is important for much of the speculation today, a thermostat cannot reset its setting. Now, people, of course, immediately object, that's very old-fashioned thermostat. We have much more clever thermostats right now and so forth, and they can even sense if I might not like the room temperature and then reset something and so forth and so on. Well, this is just figuring in some more parameters, you know, but there's still an basic algorithm on which that thermostat operates and adjusts these parameters, you know. You just add something more than just the temperature, namely me or something. But the principle is still the same. And whatever the algorithm is according to which that thermostat operates is not something the thermostat itself can change. Any algorithm, any program on which a computer runs is like a recipe, you know, do X, Y, Z in this kind of sequence and so forth and so on, given that and that kind of input. But it's like a recipe for baking cookies or making meatloaf. You know? We can upgrade a recipe. The recipe cannot upgrade itself. We can upgrade something because we can reflect on that. We can change our mind about something, right? We can choose to change our behavior around certain kind of parameters. We can change our setting in a way because we can relate to ourselves as a whole with all that's in it. Since we don't quote many theologians tonight, let me quote one, Karl Rahner. He actually has a good formulation of that. He says, a subject, like us, is a system which is once more confronted with itself as a whole and hence cannot simply be thought of on the lines of a computer made up of different parts, which in spite of all built-in controls cannot once more manipulate itself as a whole. So, but we can reflect on ourselves, and that means we can take a step away from ourselves, look at ourselves, and rethink who we want to be, at least to a certain extent. We can at least intend to do that. And that means there's an element of self-transcendence in that. And that has to do with the ability to do something new, which Turing rightly says they cannot do something new, and that's exactly the point here. There's an element of newness and creativity in that. And that, of course, is important if people are telling you computers will just outdo us and will upgrade themselves, become smarter than us, you know. You know, that they might be able to do something on a subordinate level, but as a whole, a computer cannot make a computer that's better than itself, or so I would claim. Because that would be an act of real creativity. It would be like upgrading itself or getting a new idea, wanting to be better than itself. That would be self-transcendence, but that's not a material state. You know? That configuration will be what it is, and the basic source code of that computer is not something the computer itself will rewrite. But we do that sort of thing. So we can reflect on ourselves, we can transcend ourselves, and know ourselves in that. So reflexivity means something like identity and difference, you know, identity indifference. That is, if you take a step back from yourself, that's still yourself that you're looking at. You're different from it, and yet you're identical at the same time. So it's identity and difference at once. And the taking a step back from yourself is something, taking a distance from yourself that is neither physical nor temporal, because it's in the same moment, and it's not a physical distance either. In fact, it is an identity in a difference that is utterly simple. Reflection is something that cannot be material because it is simple. If you have material states, you know, this is a material thing, you can say, okay, this can reflect on itself, so it just folded on itself, right? But then each part of that paper is touching one other part of the paper. None of the parts touches the whole, as the thought I would do. If I say I to myself, I touch each part of who I am and mean each part of who I am. Of course, I can keep folding that, you know, so I've now more parts touch more parts, but again, still not all parts touch all parts. How often do I have to fold this to get to that point? Infinitely many times, you know. And then what do you have as a result?
Not a piece of paper.
Exactly, very good. Not a piece of paper, it's a simple point. It's a mathematical point that by definition doesn't have any extension. And that means it's nothing material. Right? And that kind of simplicity underlies our mind. And in fact, I would suggest that it underlies this unified feature of the mind, to come back to that. So if you think of your mind as this field that's unified, that is what the simple thought of myself is that which unifies all of that. I mean, Immanuel Kant and others say that. And it's not even that, you know, like it's like a circle, you know, that symbolizes the field, and the simple consciousness of myself is the point in the center. No, the point is really everywhere and nowhere, because it's not really physical at all. It's part of all of that. That inhabits my mind in a similar, in an analogous way to how God is in the world. Because God is always and everywhere, precisely because he's nowhere physically. And so my mind also is always and everywhere in all my states of consciousness. Now, the final point here is that an important feature of the mind, therefore, is simplicity. And simplicity, again, is not something physical. Just as a mathematical point is nothing physical. You can even wonder, where is that thought of a mathematical point, you know, where would that in the brain be in the brain? But more importantly, in order to get to that simplicity, putting complex parts together will never get you there. So sometimes people say, well, if you just make our computer sophisticated enough, and that means complex enough, then they will be conscious. But the point is that mind and consciousness is not a problem of complexity, but of simplicity. So that has it exactly backwards. And you find that actually even in the context of God. So you know all Richard Dawkins, right? So he has this kind of weird idea, well, okay, I mean, so you need a mind to construct these complex kind of things, and so people say they need a maker, but then the maker must be even more complex, and then who makes the maker, and so forth. You know, these kind of arguments trying to make fun out of proofs of the existence of God. But the point is, you don't need something more complex, you need something simple that can put all these complex parts into something that's really unified. And that is a real leap. So evolution might, you know, bring about certain configurations of genetics and so forth and so on, but for mind to emerge, that is a real leap. And of course, evolution to the present day cannot explain how that happened. You know. It's not about complexity. People talk about irreducible complexity there too, and there's something to that as well, but I think the more important thing is it lacks simplicity. Even a living being has a kind of a unity, like an organism, like the body I talked about, that no computer has. A computer is just parts apart from each other, except that we have configured it in such a way that we see it pursuing or fulfilling certain purposes for us. So material things like computers don't have an intrinsic kind of unity. They are unified by our purposes. That's outside of the computer. It's in us, but not in them. That's yet another thing we lend to the computers. Whereas animals, for example, have that unity in themselves. And that is a leap towards simplicity that no physical configuration itself can do. And that's why evolution cannot explain life. We, to the present day, cannot make even a piece of a blade of grass or something like that. We cannot construct animals from inorganic material. omne vivum ex vivo is an old axiom. You know, all living beings come from other living beings. They don't come from dead matter. We are not able to make living beings. Why would we think that we can make conscious beings, which is much more, right? So by building these complex machines, there's exactly the leap that we cannot do for life, let alone for consciousness, has to do with that kind of simplicity. And it's that simplicity that's characteristic of our mind, especially as self-conscious mind, that in the philosophical tradition has been seen as one of the reasons for thinking that our soul is immortal. Plato thought, you know, because our soul is simple in that sense, it is immortal, because for something to die, it has to fall apart somehow. You know, so you can separate the mind from the body, that's a kind of a death, you know, but the soul itself is immortal in the sense that it itself cannot be taken further apart. Now that would require further argument. I'm just pointing that out to say that it's precisely that simplicity, it has to do with the immateriality of the soul, that also has to do with its possibility of surviving the death of the body, and yet again is then also something different from it. Only God can bring the soul into existence as the cause of this kind of simplicity, and only God would be able to separate it, but he will not. You know, so he will not let it fall into non-existence. Now to come one final time back to Alan Turing, and he's not the only one, there's some weird kind of thing. At that point, most people who think a little further in the artificial intelligence discussion know that they have a problem there. And then they appeal to God. So Alan Turing in 1940 suddenly says, well, and why would God not create a soul once we have made this sophisticated kind of computer, right? Or who is he not to do it, you know? I mean, would he perhaps, if I read another article, he would have an obligation to do that. Why would they suddenly appeal to God if they wouldn't know that there is a leap from that point on, where you have to go out from the material configurations, choose something that is different, that is a mind, that has intentionality, is unified, has the simplicity and reflexivity. That requires an additional kind of cause. Again, we cannot make even living beings. Why would we think we have made something conscious then? And so Alan Turing then says, well, maybe it is our job to provide the mansions in which God can then infuse the soul. This is literally a deus ex machina. It's quite literally, you know. They have, of course, no business appealing to God because they're materialists. They don't believe in God. They're atheists. Right? But then they will suddenly appeal to God. It's really strange, you know, but they seem to feel that there is a need there. Now, I would say God already gave us a process by which we provide mansions for him to infuse souls. It's called procreation. It's called marriage. It's begetting children. And that is like the life I talked about. All living beings come from other living beings. That is also where we should expect conscious beings to come from, namely from ourselves or from other animals, and self-conscious beings to come from beings like ourselves. So I hope, you know, with that picture, you see that the burden of proof is quite squarely with those who claim that computers would be conscious or self-conscious. There's a huge gap to cover, and they acknowledge that sometimes themselves. And there are no reasons to really assume that. And as long as we are not concerned about the immortality of computers and so forth, we also have no reasons to baptize them. That's right. So I think that was plenty long. But we take questions. Yeah. Yes, any questions you want. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the material worldview underlying it necessitates a sort of determinism. And this determinism is incompatible with the concept of free will.
Yes.
And so there seems to be this concept that if we could only simulate, if we only had enough data, if we could reproduce every single experience, every input that you've had as a human being, we could reproduce and predict how you would react in any given scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems obviously hubristic to me, but it also necessitates that we deny free will. And then those that would postulate this tend to not live in that manner, that would deny free will, because this would eradicate all law.
That would have been a final step that I have on my list of free will, but that's a different talk. I can give you free will talk another time. But that's exactly right. Because our free will also does not have a physical organ. Just as the brain is not the organ of our mind, of our conscious, self-conscious mind, so also free will does not have a physical organ. That's what Thomas Aquinas says. And for these reasons, free will has to do with reflexivity. Free will has to do with our self-conscious awareness of things that allow us to take a step back from that, including of who we are. That's the newness and creativity that is part of making a free choice. We can change our mind. You know, we can do something else. So there's a zone of freedom or a space of freedom, of possibilities that opens up with that, which no material thing has. So it's quite right here. Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody else.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments on machine learning with regard to this? Because I'm curious if as machine learning advances, the algorithms, if eventually they gave machines the potential to do these things, would that change the
conversation? Again, I think they might simulate it without actually doing it. So the neural networks, you know, they allow something we call sort of pattern recognition, you know, for example. You know? And that sounds a little bit more like this unified field of consciousness, perhaps. You know? But is the neural network itself aware of that? So, I mean, people who work in that field don't seem to feel tempted to think that, because I think it's just a bunch of statistics. So you adjust the various, I forget how you call this, parameters, you know, that are the vectors and so forth. But it is, in any case, something that operates still on a kind of an algorithm. There's a learning algorithm. You know? And the neural network doesn't learn how to change its own learning algorithms because it relies on the algorithm to do what it does. You know? So reflexivity doesn't figure in there, and therefore the self-upgrading. On the lower level, they probably can do all sorts of things. I would give them a lot of advance credit on what is, might be possible there. But it's not a form of reflexivity, nor do I think is there something literally conscious of anything. We read that as recognizing a pattern. But in the machine, these are all causal processes. There's nothing, there's no intentionality, there's no awareness of anything. There's no reason why we should think that, because it's hitting, you know, sensors or something like that, and then it's filtered down in these levels and however that works, you know. But at the end, you have a process that summarizes all that information in some way. But that just means it leads to one unified causal output, not an awareness thereof.
Isn't awareness learned, though, as a human?
No. In order to learn something, you have to have awareness already.
Okay.
I mean, what we call machine learning is not literally learning. I mean, again, it's something we read into the machine, I think. You know, learning is itself a form of intentionality. You explore something, you want to gain something, you pursue knowledge. And this is just accumulation of more causal kind of states in a machine that, for our purposes, we can read as learning. We find out something, and we construct a machine that can do certain things. So I wouldn't even literally attribute learning to the machine itself. And much as that is very sophisticated, you know, I'm sure they can do all sorts of things now with that, you know. But that is not itself a form of intentionality, nor does it account for reflexivity. I haven't even talked about universality, that's a whole other thing. But that, I think, is an important question, and I have looked into that. I'm not a computer person, you know, but from all I could see, it's not anything that would make that case. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the talk. It's been very interesting. So, for recently in my life, I sort of like got wrapped up in tech and almost thought I should pursue a career in it, and this, that, and the other. And the whole point of singularity and the development of AI and everyone's timeline for when consciousness is going to come to our machines is probably still the talk of the town. And so this talk has been very comforting, frankly, because during that whole time of reading all these articles and reading people's thoughts and like all the subject matter on it, it's actually very alarming and unsettling to think of like our total pursuit of this whole like, let's make machines conscious and smarter and able to dominate us, but we don't know what's going to happen. And I just wanted to know, what is your thought on our human pursuit of that, and why are we trying to do that in the first place? I know on a smaller level, some people want to like solve certain cancers with, you know, machine learning or whatever, or identify them or do this. But on a grander level, you have these like people who literally want this sort of like conscious machine, and whether it's good or bad, they want it. And I just, it's alarming to me that we have a lot of humanity that's targeting.
I think the reason why we do that is because we're not computers. We have this ability for self-transcendence and newness, and we just go for it. You know, I mean, we'll, that is itself an incentive. There are ever new horizons we explore, you know. I mean, there are a lot of subordinate kind of reasons. Yes, there are technologies that are very helpful and very good to develop, you know, and they're very, the machines alleviate a whole lot of problems and very good and important things. We should acknowledge that, you know. I mean, helping us get rid of waste and things like that, and environmental kind of things. So there are plenty of reasons that way. They reduce labor, but it has then, of course, all sorts of side effects. You know, it puts people out of work and so forth and so on. So we know all these kind of problems. That is a whole kind of separate topic, the ethical issues. But at the end of the day, I think we also just do that because we can. And we are just curious kind of animals. You know, there's always more. And just as we like to know, as Aristotle says, you know, every human being likes to see. And why? Because we all like to know. We all like to know more. You know, there's wonder and there's more and we explore. And I think ultimately, of course, we want to know God, who isn't the infinite that we can know. But short of that, well, we explore always more. We like to explore outer space. Why do we do that? Is there anything useful in that? No. But there's just no limit to our that kind of self-transcendence until we reach God. So I think that's part of that, you know. And of course, it reflects back to us how powerful we are, that we can do that kind of stuff, you know, and outdo each other. I mean, at MIT, I mean, they just do that for the fun of it, you know. They're a bit of workaholics, as far as I understood, and even in their spare time, they get together and try, let's construct a self-driving car that can drive across the continent or something like that. Just for the fun of it, you know. And so they might be peculiar, but I mean, some of that we all have, I think, you know. So it is where it goes wrong, it's the distortion of actually something good or great capability that we have.
So once again, this is Father Michael, bringing to conclusion today's lecture. I hope you certainly enjoyed it. After the lecture, someone came up to me and said, wow, that was really fascinating, but there was so much information. Could you summarize it for me? And I always joke with Father Anselm that I ask him if he's giving a particular talk, can he summarize it for me? And he says, no, you cannot summarize things. He says, you have to give the whole. He has that kind of mind that holds all of the arguments and details in his prodigious mind. But just to give an attempt to glean perhaps the salient points from certainly what I took away from the talk, the idea then when you ask, are machines or are robots or could artificial intelligence be on the same level or have a kind of a parity with human nature? You can come at it from two ways, right? You can ask either, can robots do something equivalent to human beings? Or you can ask, can human beings do something that is so distinctively human that no robot or material thing could actually approximate that? And in the talk, through his preface, Father Anselm raised a number of things to kind of set the context, but he comes at it from that latter point of view, that is, to show that our mind is not reducible to the brain. That is, the brain is not, in a sense, the organ of the mind in a materialistic way, and that there's more to us than simply matter. And pointing out five different arguments or windows into the immateriality of the soul, that sense of quality, that sense of unity or identity, a sense in which we are reflexive. We can reflexively cogitate on our own thought itself, even questions around our choice and free will, as he mentioned at the end. So five different elements of immateriality that give us a sense that our human life and experience go well beyond what can be explained simply by the material world or synapses or neurons firing. And at the very end, Father Anselm treated the other question, kind of his take on the Turing test. That is, are there things that would let us know that robots or artificial intelligence approximate human beings? And he said, although we use that language of intentionality, one of the qualities that go beyond our material human experience, that sense of intentionality, although we talk about machines having intentionality, he argues that they can't have intentionality, strictly speaking. And it's kind of litmus test here is the fact that there is no example. In fact, humans have not been able to bring something from non-being or non-life to life. In other words, there's no human, even though we can take seeds and you can take, you know, sperm and egg and put them together and bring about life, those seeds, those eggs have the potential for life. And so there's no non-living substance that human beings right now can give the spark of life to. There's an infinite gap there, a chasm that no kind of science has been able to bridge. And so the argument is, if that human beings at this point cannot bring to life from inorganic matter, how much more can we not suppose that we can bring inorganic matter to a place of consciousness? That is a very specific and highly complex form of life. And so it's a kind of a fortiori argument that certainly is very compelling. So two ways to go about the kind of question of artificial intelligence versus a kind of approximation to the human person. One, to show that the human person is more than matter, and on the other, to say that human beings cannot or have not yet created something that can bridge the basic kind of test for life that we would be sure that would be more than just a kind of verisimilitude. So I hope you enjoyed the talk, if you've still lasted all the way through. Bonus points. I was teasing Father Anselm after the fact that I think he should have given some credits. If someone wants to sign up for a special reading course, they should get at least a half a credit for tonight's lecture. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so may all that you do truly radiate the joy of the gospel here in the heart of the city.